Welcome back everyone to the Dark Forest. If you're new to the channel, consider subscribing. Download your favorite scary story on my Apple Podcast and Spotify, Tales from the Dark Forest. Now, let's get into this monstrous story. October 11th, 8:54 a.m. Scott Grove navigated the Lincoln into the alley running between a dry cleaner's and the First National Bank, and parked near the overflowing dumpster. In the passenger seat, Kevin Warner pulled on a ski mask and cocked his Beretta. In the back seat, Derek and Connor did the same. Scott checked the clock on his dash. 8:55. "Ready?" Kevin asked. "Frickin' A," Derek said with a fevered grin. A tall blonde man with crazy eyes and bad teeth. Derek liked the hurt people. Kevin called him a loose cannon, sounding for all the world like the upright commissioner on the Lethal Weapon movie. And Scott agreed. Since July, they had pulled off 5 bank robberies across the country. And Derek was always too rough with the hostages. Too brutal. In Topeka, he beat a bank teller with the stock of his rifle, and in Austin, after making everyone stretch out on the floor, he went across kicking them and giggling like a child until Kevin yelled at him to stop. Then there was Reno. Their method was simple. Mask up, go in, and force everyone to get down. Simple bank robbery crap. It's a classic for a reason. Sometimes they tied the tellers up, sometimes they didn't. In Reno, Derek tied one of the tellers up with duct tape. Instead of putting a single strip over her mouth like a normal person, he wound half a frickin' roll across her face, over her mouth, nose, and eyes. She suffocated to death. Kevin told Scott that he wanted to waste Derek, but couldn't bring himself to do it. "He's gonna get us caught and frickin' executed," Kevin said. Had Derek been an outsider, Scott believed that Kevin would have shot him and dumped his body into a ditch, but he wasn't. He was one of their brothers in arms, the 4 of them, with Kevin as their group leader. And they have all been through some hairy crap in Iraq. And it's true what they say about bonds you form in the army. You don't fight beside someone and then turn around and put a bullet to their skull, unless you're a nutcase like Derek. Presently, Kevin threw the door open and climbed out, the others following. They went around the trunk and opened it, putting on ski masks and taking out M16s like the ones Uncle Sam used to issue the boys in the field. Scott remained behind the wheel, his hands at 10-2 and his back straight. He kept his eyes forward and his gun close. 34 and thin with reddish hair and cloudy hazel eyes, Scott was loyal. Maybe too loyal. He had no family before joining the army, though he yearned for one. And when he finally found one, he gave himself to it entirely. He had his own thoughts and feelings, but you wouldn't be far off if you called him a robot. He did what he was programmed to do, and that was that. Kevin and others were there for him when society kicked him away. They genuinely cared for him. Who else cared about him? His druggy parents? The pink-haired SJWs who hated him for being a straight white man? The Republican Christian hypocrites who call him a parasite because he was too poor or too straight? Screw them. Screw them all. The only people who had his back were the ones in his squad, and he would have their backs. Unless crap went too bad. Then they were on their own. Kev, Derek, and Connor started down the alley. Before reaching the busy street, they turned and disappeared into the alley running behind the bank. Scott knew there was a loaded dock where armored cars parked. The next car wasn't due till noon, but that was okay. It was safer to go after the bank itself anyways. While he waited, Scott divided his attention between the street and the rearview mirror. During the heists, he went into a state of hypervigilance that one may only learn from open combat. He was aware of every sound, every flicker of movement, every errant smell, He did not turn the radio on. He did not light a cigarette. He only observed. The clock on the dash read 9:01. In the street, a car backfired and Scott's heart jolted. He glanced over his shoulder, and Kevin was there, emerging from the alley behind the bank and falling to his knees. For a minute, Scott couldn't process what he was seeing. Then it hit him, and his stomach dropped. Bam, bam, bam! Kevin struggled to his feet and started staggering towards the car, his right hand pressed on his stomach. His rifle was gone, as was his mask. His face was white and drawn. Shoot. Something went wrong. Something went real frickin' wrong. In that moment, Scott had a decision to make. Gun it, and get the hell out of there, or save his commanding officer from enemy fire. Scott started to open the door, his calm cracking, but then in the mirror, a uniformed security guard rounded a corner and aimed his gun at Kevin. Kevin fell to his knees and crawled weakly towards the car, reaching one blood-stained hand as if in supplication. Scott glimpsed something in his CO's eyes that had never seen there and never imagined he would. Fear. Kevin was the strongest and most fearless man Scott had ever known, and right now he was terrified. Scott's composure crumbled and he made a decision. He drew the Lincoln into drive and punched the gas. The car surged forward with a low, guttural vroom, and the back tires screamed on the pavement. The front end clipped an overflowing metal garbage can, knocking it aside, and then he was on Central Street, cars braking hard and swerving to avoid him. He wrenched the wheel to the right, teeth clenched, and almost slammed into the back of a city bus. The car fishtailed, and for a horrible moment he thought he was going to crash, but it corrected, and he pushed the gas to the floor, shooting past a line of traffic. When he got to the intersection of Center and Palm Avenue, he ran a red light and turned left. The highway rose and curved to the left, the buildings falling away near the top, brown California scrubland beyond. He was out of town proper when he realized how hard his heart was pounding. His hands trembled on the wheel and he couldn't catch his breath, though he was dying. What now? Scott's mind raced. He was an animal backed into a corner with nowhere to go. What should he do? What could he do? An idea occurred to him, and he started east. Sheriff Steve Berman slung his rifle over his shoulder and brought his horse Hellfire to kneel. Ahead, past a wild flat valley covered with snow, a craggy mountain rose into the misty sky. Sucking in a frosty breath, Berman lifted the binoculars to his glasses and scanned the lower ridges circling the mountain. A few canted pine trees leaned across here and there, but for the most part, his view was unobstructed.
See anything? Todd Wesley asked.
Berman swept his glasses left, right, and left again. No, he said. He let the binoculars dangle from their strap and looked at Wesley. Like Berman himself, the deputy was wearing a green jacket, white Stetson, and mirrored glasses. Though Wesley was younger, thinner, and a bit more taller, to Berman it was like looking into a mirror. People often mistook Wesley for his son, and while he laughed it off, Berman often wondered how it would feel to have a son. His only child was a daughter, Sandy, who moved to Denver with their boyfriend when Annie died 3 years ago. Berman loved her fiercely, but he always wanted a son, someone to hunt and fish and play ball with.
It's been a week, Wesley said presentedly. The boy's dead.
Berman sighed.
Yeah. But I want to find him, before anyone else does.
Wesley glanced from Berman to the mountain ahead.
You don't really think it got him, do you?
The him in question was 18-year-old Chase Billings from San Francisco, a college kid. He and a couple of his damn fool friends were hiking south of town when Chase got separated and disappeared on October 7th.
When his friends reported it, they said that they heard him screaming from somewhere deep in the woods.
Maybe he stubbed his toe, Wesley offered, but Berman knew in his heart that the beast got him, even though conventional wisdom said the beast only ate once a year.
Let's go, Berman said. He suddenly felt like he was being watched.
They rode the 5 miles back to Highway 10, which winds through the barren hills surrounding Pine Point. The green and white cruiser was parked at the soft shoulder facing south, its passenger side tires lost in a mess of black sludge. In the car, Wesley hopped down and helped Berman tie his horse to Hellfire.
See you back in town, Wesley said, climbing into the car.
He started the engine, pulled a U-turn, and beeped as he disappeared over the rise. Steve Berman glanced over his shoulder. Scott Grove rounded a bend and the hills flanking the highway fell away, revealing a small valley cast in the shadows of surrounding mountains, their snow-covered slopes angling down and eventually melding with the valley floor. The town of Pine Point looked like a postcard snapshot from here, its streets narrow, its skyline dominated by a rising church spire, a red brick schoolhouse, and a white water tower. Vehicles moved slowly along the streets, cautious of the ice. It had snowed the night before, and more was on the way. Just before Highway 10 crossed Stegler Creek, it became Main Street. Scott turned left onto a dirt road and held tight to the wheel as the 1998 model Blazer shook and trembled. The road led up over a hill, then crept along a narrow ridgeline before disappearing into the pine forests, overlooking the southern end of town. The cabin was nearly a mile back, tucked away amongst the dense underbrush. It was easy to miss. Scott overshot the drive and had to turn around even though he knew the way. The cabin belonged to his grandparents. His grandfather built the place in the summer of 1967. He used it primarily for vacations, but spent the last 10 years of his life there before dying in 2018. His grandmother was in a nursing home in Fresno. The place was in her name, and no one ever came out here, making it a perfect place to lay low for a while. Scott parked the Blazer under a drooping tree and cut the engine, killing Cardi B mid-suck. With the heater off, the cold began creeping in at once. It had been 3 days since the botched bank robbery at the First National Bank of San Francisco, which left 2 robbers and 1 security guard dead. Derek made it out with a bullet in his shoulder and tried to flee on foot, but the cops ran him down and arrested him. Assuming he was telling everything he knew, Scott had to be careful. He ditched the Lincoln and bought the Blazer from an old man with cash, and traveled through the eastern California mountains on little used back roads. No one knew about the cabin, and he would be safe here. At least, that's what he told himself. Though he hadn't been here since he was 12, the cabin looked just as he remembered it. Dirty, earthy, and small, with roughly hewn timber walls and a rusty metal roof. The stone chimney was crooked, and the porch canted, as though sagging beneath the weight of years. It wasn't much, but it was good enough to hold him until he decided what his next move was. Opening the door, Scott jumped out of the Blazer, his boots crunching in a thin layer of unbroken snow. The bitter cold instantly sapped the heat from his body, and his breath misted in front of him as he picked his way to the Blazer's rear. He opened the tailgate and stopped. Should he take the license plate off? What if someone came by for some reason and saw it? Suddenly paranoid, he wished the Blazer would spontaneously combust. He was close enough to walk anywhere he needed to go. Signed in frustration, he went to the passenger side, opened the door, and popped the glove box. From inside, he withdrew a green-handled screwdriver. He unscrewed the plates, stashed them under the passenger seat, and closed the door, satisfied for the moment. He grabbed a single bag from the cargo compartment, heaved it over his shoulder, and slammed the door. A breeze kicked up then, and the icy talons of Old Man Winter raked his already numb face. He carried the bag to the little covered porch, dropped it, and fished for his pockets for the keys. When his grandfather went into the nursing home in 2018, her lawyer gave him a key for safekeeping. Why? Scott didn't know. He barely knew his grandparents, and didn't like what he did know about them. Key in hand, he unlocked the door and stepped inside, the smell of the closed-in ozone washing over him. The temperature outside was 29, according to the radio. Inside, it felt significantly colder. Reflexively shivering, he grabbed the bag and shut the door behind him. The layout was simple. One open space in a single room. The living room had a couch, an armchair, a cabinet radio with record storage below, and a stone fireplace. The kitchen featured an oven and stove, an old-fashioned icebox and cabinets. Grandpa ate his meals in his chair, Scott remembered, while listening to the radio. There was a pile of wood on the hearth. Scott built a fire, and when it was roaring, he went into the bedroom. A single bed flanked by nightstands, a dresser, a chair facing the window. Muted light fell through the pane. Scott went over to it and looked out. A snow-covered yard sloped up to a stand of trees. There was a shed amongst the brush. He remembered playing in it as a kid. Motes of dust dancing in shafts of sunlight. He was certain he'd find a hatchet tacked to the wall. It occurred to him then that the place probably didn't have power. He tried the switch by the door and nothing happened. Dang. At least he had heat. That was the most important thing. In the living room, he toured the kitchen. The icebox was empty, but the cabinets were crammed with cans and jars. Most of the stuff had expired in 2020. Some of it was good until 2027. In the living room, Scott hunched down next to the fireplace and let the heat wash over him. It was going to be a long winter. Sheriff Steve Berman walked south from the police station on Main and Faye's Diner, which occupied a ground floor lot below the town hotel. It was just after noon when he stepped in, an hour into the lunch rush. As he suspected, the diner was nearly empty, save for a few men sitting at the counter and talking to Mel, the owner, a short, wiry man with graying hair. Mel Terissi had been in Pine Point since 2002. He was originally from Staten Island, and Berman could never get quite used to his brash New York accent. When he entered, Mel looked up, saw him, and smiled.
"How you doing?"
"I'm good," Berman said. He shrugged out of his coat, hung it on the rack by the door, and went over to the counter, settling down next to Dave Steele, a beefy man in a vest and cap. David worked for the Sunlight Mining Company in Rocky Top, the county seat.
"Hi, Sheriff,"
Steele said. Berman nodded nicely. When he wasn't working, David Steele was drinking and smacking his wife around. He was simpering and polite to everyone else but her. He was a big man with hard fists. Berman hated a lot of things in this sick world, but women beaters and child abusers took the cake.
"You eatin'?" Mel asked.
"Yeah," Berman said, stretching and popping his back. "Gimme a burger and fries." Mel nodded and turned, shouting through the little window to the kitchen.
"You find that boy?" Steele asked.
"Nope," Berman replied. After returning to town, he had wisely rounded up a few people and head back out to the mountain, Death Mountain, as the locals call it. "Don't take the horses," he said. "If you get too close to the beast, they'll get nervous." Wesley had nodded and set about raising a posse. As the day wore on, Berman pondered if it was really that important that his men find the kid's body first. There were bears and bobcats in the hills. If anyone else stumbled across the body, he could always blame them for it. That might attract too much attention, though, and get people talking. People talking was bad. Real bad.
State police looking for him, ain't they?
Steele asked.
Berman nodded.
Probably the National Guard, too.
Mel shook his head. All for a frickin' hipster kid?
He chuckled bitterly.
Berman nodded.
Yeah.
He hoped that the beast took the kid back to its lair.
But what if the state boys found the lair?
That thought sent a chill down Berman's spine. He'd been out there before. Hell, he was the one who brought the thing its yearly sacrifice, and he knew the shape it was in. Bones, some animals and other human littered the floor, drifting 5 feet high in places like snowbanks in hell. Scratch marks covered the walls, and the rancid stench of death clogged the air, filling your lungs and making your eyes water. That was just the cave. God only knew what its den looked like.
Acid gurgled up Berman's stomach. The cave mouth was hard to find, though. They'd have to be looking for it specifically to find it.
Maybe the monster got him, Mel said and laughed.
Steele laughed, too.
Neither one of them knew how close to the truth they were. Everyone knew the legends of the thing living in the caves crisscrossing Death Mountain, but very few people knew that the legends were true. The sheriff knew. The mayor knew. A few others. Only those who had to, and a few who had stumbled across the truth on their own. One was a drunk no one believed. The other was buried in a shallow grave outside of town, with the same caliber bullet in its cranium that Berman's pistol took. And another still was an old Indian shaman who lived in the foothills. Berman lived in Pine Point for 20 years before being elected sheriff, and thought he had heard the stories just like anyone else. He thought they were tall tales. His first day on the job, Mayor Tom Anderson called him into his office and pushed the stack of papers across his desk.
Read this.
The first report of the thing came from a French fur trapper named Jean Baptiste, who arrived in California via Oregon in 1845. He had dealings with local Indians, and they told him of a monster who lived inside the mountain. They called it a Wenampital. Their tradition said the Wenampital was a fierce warrior who enjoyed raping and pillaging more than was socially acceptable. After raping and murdering a shaman's daughter, he was cursed and turned into a hideous beast with rotting flesh, sparse white fur, and fangs. Being from a civilized world, Baptiste disbelieved the rumors and took a team of hard-headed braves with him to the Cursed Valley. That night, while camping under the stars, Baptiste woke to the sound of screaming. In the half-light of a summer moon, he glimpsed the thing as it ripped the braves apart. He described it as 6 feet tall and weighing close to 200 pounds. The thing spared Baptiste, and he got it into his head that he was special. He lived in the valley for nearly 20 years, running a post before disappearing in 1864. By that time, a town had grown up around his general store. Baptiste was a talker. He told anyone who would listen about the creature, but no one believed him. The beast isn't known to have struck during the day, and in retrospect, it was likely that Baptiste was feeding it with travelers he kidnapped from his store. Either way, without Baptiste feeding it, the creature got hungry. On December 8, 1864, it came out of the hills and tore through town, killing 6 people and wounding several others. A group of men managed to fight it off, but when they tracked it to the cave, it attacked them, killing all but one. That man, Abraham Winston, emerged from his tussle with the beast changed. He was the first one to suggest feeding the beast with the scum of society, leading to the yearly ritual of leaving a degenerate townsperson into the cave. Since then, the beast had been fed regularly, and as far as Berman knew, it never came out of its lair. But this time, he knew it had. He could feel it in his bones. And if the thing was getting restless, it meant things. Very bad things.
Got more snow on the way, Mel said.
Berman looked up. He was talking to Ben Potts, who ran the grocery store. Ben must have come in while Berman was wool-gathering. A tall, thin man with pale blonde hair and tiny wire-rimmed glasses. Ben was one of a few people in Pine Point who still knew about the Beast. He served a term as mayor from 1986 through 1988.
TV says it's gonna be a bad one, Ben said.
Lovely, Mel said. When's it start?
Oh, in another hour or two.
When Berman's lunch arrived, he almost didn't want it. Almost. At 1:15 p.m. Western Standard Time, on the afternoon of October 12, 2023, it began to snow. The storm, the biggest one seen in the mountains of eastern California since the 50s, moved in from across the north and stalled across a wide path of the state's highest ranges. Meteorologists initially predicted a foot, but as the afternoon wore on, it became clear that the storm would dump on 3 feet in some places. The first casualty of the storm was a traveling Bible salesman from Cedar Rapids. He lost control of his Buick on I-80 west of Yuma Pass and slammed into a Mack truck. The Buick was sucked under the truck's big tires and crushed. The snow fell so fast along State Route 49 that a line of cars were trapped near Loyalton. 6 people eventually froze to death. 3 more managed to trek 5 miles overland to the town of Franklin. The media would liken the tragedy to the Donor Party, a group of pioneers who were trapped by snow in the Sierra Nevada in 1846. But of course they would. Anything to sell papers and get a few extra viewers for the nightly newscast. 115 miles south of SR 49, as the crows flies, the storm hit Pine Point like a fist. By 1:59 p.m., a thick curtain of snow fell sideways over the town. From the warmth of his office, Sheriff Stephen Berman watched as the town's single traffic light swung wildly in the wind. Southwest of town, deep in its lair beneath Death Mountain, the creature stirred. Its sleep fitful and plagued by hunger pains. At one point, the shrieking of the wind as it swept along the mountain slopes woke the creature, and it sat up, fully conscious for the first time since taking the boy from the woods the week before. A sudden spasm of hunger seized the thing, and it cried out. Its voice echoed through the tomb-like chambers honeycombing the mountain. It needed food. It needed blood. It left its lair and came out into the storm. In the distance, the lights of Pine Point twinkled through the snow. Scott Grove sat by the fire and listened to the ghostly screaming of the wind in the eaves. At one point, he got up and went to the window. It was coming down so heavy, he could barely see the crumbling facade of the shed 10 feet away. He was worried. He knew it was supposed to snow, but something about the quality of the storm told him it was going to be bad. For a moment, he stood undecisively in the kitchen, then, throwing on a jacket, rushed out into the blazer. Behind the wheel, he put the key into the ignition and listened to 3 shitty pop songs before the news came on.
Much of Eastern California is in the bullseye right now,
the anchor said.
Expect blizzard conditions from Fort Bidwell south to Colville. Wind gusts of nearly 70 miles per hour, high drifts, and up to 3 feet of snow. Expect conditions to continue into tomorrow afternoon.
When another song came on, Scott cut the engine and flopped back against the seat. This was bad. He could survive being snowbound for a few days, sure, but he didn't have enough wood to feed a constant fire. He planned to chop some up later in the afternoon, but now he wouldn't get a chance until tomorrow afternoon, and even then it would be difficult. Sighing, Scott got out of the blazer and went back into the cabin. He would have to chop some now, he decided, before too much snow piled up. Going out the back door, he hunched against the snow pelting his face and rushed to the shed. He opened the door, rusty hinges shrieking, and went inside. The air smelled of gasoline,
oil, and other less nameable things. The light was poor. He had to feel along the wall to find the axe, hung in the same general area he remembered. Axe in hand, Scott pushed open the door and stepped out into the storm.
Just then, a high undulating cry cut through the storm. Scott's heart leapt into his throat and his grip tightened reflexively on the axe. Turning towards the forest, he caught a glimpse of something moving beyond the veil of snow. For a brief second it was exposed, and then it was gone behind the trunk of a tree. For a long moment, Scott stood where he was, rooted in place by fear. He thought he didn't get too good of a look at the thing. He thought it was a bear, an extremely large and misshapen bear. Scott didn't know much about bears, but he did know that they had teeth and claws. What should he do? Play dead? Make noise? Do bears scare off? Or was that mountain lions? Maybe it was gone. As if on cue, the thing slipped from behind the tree. There was a brief lull in the storm, and Scott saw it for what it really was. He gasped. Standing well over 6 feet, its back hunched as if against the storm, the thing wasn't a bear. It walked on 2 feet, its arms swung at its sides, and when it heard him and turned, he saw that its face was undeniably human. Human and dead. Its flesh was a sickly gray color, and its eyes shone with yellow malevolence. When it spotted him, its mouth opened and a small, unhuman sound of triumph burst forth. Yellow, razor-sharp fangs glistened in the dying light of the day. The thing started towards him, and Scott, still paralyzed with terror, turned and ran. He made it less than 5 feet before the thing was on him, pushing him down and swiping at his back and head with wicked claws. Scott screamed and mercifully lost consciousness. The thing ripped open his back and greedily pressed its mouth to the wounds. Elated, the monster cried out. Steve Berman sat behind the big oak desk in his office and listened to the distant voices of the radio before him. There were faint and staticky, words from a far planet. Cars were going off the road left and right, and highways were quickly becoming impassable. Towns scattered across the mountains were going dark. Someone plowed into the pumps of a Shell station in Wesso. An old man died of a heart attack walking from his abandoned car. It was almost like the world was coming to an end. Berman had a bad feeling. Leaning over, he opened a drawer and came back with a bottle of whiskey and a glass. He poured a measure into the glass and took a sip. The liquor hot as it slid into his stomach, where it detonated like a bomb. Though he rarely drank, he kept the whiskey on hand for emergencies, and if today wasn't an emergency, he didn't know what was. He was just finishing when the lights flickered. Beautiful. Pine Point regularly lost power in big storms. Most everyone had a generator, but there were some who didn't, and when things got bad, they usually wound up coming to the police station. Berman didn't mind, not really. Since Anne died, he didn't have much to go home to anyways. Not for the first time, he wished Sandy hadn't left. He wished he could go home and find her there. They could have dinner and talk and be together. He should really call her, he reckoned. He hadn't talked to her since July. The sound of her voice suddenly appealed a great deal to him. He reached for his phone just as a knock came on the door, startling him.
Come in.
Tom Wesley poked his head in. Berman instantly knew something was wrong. Edna Yancey just called, Wesley said. Edna Yancey, 82 and frail, lived in a tiny house on the far bank of the river. She was once a rough pioneer-type woman, and distrusted the government with a passion equaled only by those Antifa kids in Portland. If she was calling, something big was going on.
She said that she saw a monster.
Wesley's words struck Berman like a fist.
Saw it? Berman asked.
He sounded calm, even numb, but inside his heart was beginning to pound. Wesley nodded.
She said that she was looking out the window and saw it come out of the woods. It's heading down towards the highway.
Jeezo.
If it was out...
Berman stood.
Come on.
Outside, a gust of wind swept up the street. Wet flecks of snow pummeled them as they dashed to the Bronco. Inside, Berman gunned the engine.
What does it want? Wesley was asking.
Berman spun the Bronco around and started south towards the bridge. The streets were empty, save for a few lost souls on their way God knows where.
Blood, Berman said.
There was only one reason for the thing being out walking around. The yearly feedings weren't enough anymore. Damn it, the bastard needed more. From the police station, Main Street curved and started down before leveling out and crossing the bridge. As they came over the rise, Berman saw the thing walking along the center lane of the bridge.
Oh my God,
Wesley said, fear evident in his voice. He had never seen the beast.
Grab the shotgun,
Berman barked. Panic was beginning to close around him like a noose. The monster stopped and looked at them, its eyes moist with evil intelligence. Its white fur was matted and fluttered in the wind. Its body was solid, its arms and legs powerful. Standing there, in the driving snow, it was a nightmare apparition, and Berman realized something. He was terrified. A burst of wind blew hard, and a power line running along the street came loose with the bright flash of electricity. It swung across the road, and Berman slammed on the brakes to avoid hitting it. A car came up behind the monster, its headlights cutting through the snow. The creature turned to face it, and the driver hit the brakes, coming to a shaky stop. Not missing a beat, the monster threw itself at the car, battering the passenger side window.
Shit!
Wesley cried. He threw open the door and scrambled out, shotgun in hand. Berman opened his own door and jumped out, pulling his revolver from his holster as he went.
Freeze!
Wesley cried. The car's driver hit the gas, pulled a hard turn, and drove on to the bridge, where it slid on the ice and fishtailed, spinning around, and slamming into the little concrete wall running along the edge with such force that the cement cracked. As if shocked, the monster stood dumbly in the middle of the street, looking after the car.
Freeze!
Wesley cried again. Seeming to hear him, the monster turned around, and for a terrible second, it and Berman locked eyes. He had never seen its face, only those shiny yellow eyes watching him from the shadows as he left its annual sacrifice. He had plenty of time to wonder what that face looked like, but the reality was more terrible than anything he could have ever imagined. Its flesh was tight and bluish. In places, it had rotted away, revealing the bone beneath. Tatters of skin hung around its yawning mouth, and its crooked teeth were sharp as razors, hell, maybe even sharper. The monster screamed out and started walking towards them. Berman's heart sputtered, and he found himself falling back a step. The power line had come to a rest, hanging limply from its pole. It was 15 feet away when Wesley fired. A smattering of buckshot struck the beast square in the chest. It jerked and half-turned, but didn't stop. Wesley pulled the trigger again. The creature didn't stop.
Jesus! Jesus!
Berman raised the revolver and got off 3 shots. The first 2 went wild, crashing into the storm and disappearing. The 3rd struck the thing directly in the forehead.
It kept coming.
Run!
Berman screamed. He turned, nearly lost his footing, and started running up the street. The sidewalk was filled with people now. They came from shops and stores like cockroaches drawn by the gunfire.
Get inside!
Berman yelled and waved them back.
Get inside!
A few of them gasped. Berman looked over his shoulder just as Todd Wesley went down with a scream. The creature was on him.
Jesus, no!
Berman turned on the beast and squeezed off 3 shots. Each one hit their target. The beast continued its attack on Wesley. The man fought, thrashed, and screamed. Then he was still. Someone howled in terror.
Inside! Berman yelled. For the love of God, inside!
Scott Grove made it to the blazer before collapsing in a snowdrift and blacking out. When he came to, his face, fingers, and toes were numb. He got to his feet and managed to get behind the wheel and close the door before the blackness took him over again. The next time he woke, he was puking down his shirt. He was weak, lightheaded, so much blood. Working sluggishly, half out of consciousness, Scott got the blazer started and managed to back it out onto the road. When he was sure he wasn't going to pass out again, he put it in the drive and started down the track to the highway. The snow fell with fury, drifts flanked the road. When the trees cleared, Scott saw the smoke at once, rising from the heart of town. It was thick and black. He started losing consciousness again. He had to get help. At the blacktop, his head spinning, he turned left and hit the gas. His vision was grain. He didn't see the car abandoned in the middle of the bridge. When he hit it, he was going 25 miles an hour. Not fast, but fast enough to send him flying through the windshield. Fast enough to knock him unconscious one final time. At 3:45 p.m., Pine Point lost power. Homes as far as 10 miles away were plunged into darkness. In town, the creature forced its way into Faye's diner, smashing a glass door with its giant fists. Mel Tarisi shot it 3 times with a Colt 45, before it grabbed him by his throat and threw him across the room. One of 3 people cowering inside, 2 escaped. Mel didn't. Its fur dyed red with blood, the creature sipping through Faye's darkened kitchen and came out into the alleyway. Doors dotted the far wall, bags of trash piled on either side of them. The creature slunk down the gravel lane, sniffing here, smelling there. Back on Main Street, it headed north, deeper into town. At the top of the street, it came to a Shell station. Attached to it was a garage, its roll-up doors standing open. Moving quick and low, it crossed the street and started to run when it saw a man in overalls standing in the garage. The man had time to let out 1 short, high-pitched scream before the beast knocked him down and ripped his throat out. The taste of hot, coppery blood was intoxicating. When the creature was satisfied, it left the garage.
"There it is!"
someone screamed. A man in a pair of jeans and a sheepskin jacket was standing in front of the grocery store. 2 more men ran up the street from the south. All of them were carrying rifles. The creature started towards them, and one of them fired. The shot missed the creature and slammed into one of the gas pumps, which exploded. The force of the blast knocked the creature down, but it was up again and running in a flash, this time away. The men gave chase.
"I don't have time to explain,"
Steve Berman yelled into the handset across town.
"I need people fast."
The state police dispatcher came back with a 10-4. Help was on the way. Shaking, Berman went to the window and looked out onto the street. Snow fell more quickly than before. The town was dark, silent. Suddenly, the day was filled with light. A loud crack followed, and the window shook in its frame.
Jeezo! The Shell station!
He had to stop this. In the hall, Berman opened the gun cabinet to which only he had the keys. He took out 2 shotguns and a rifle. Outside, he started towards the street, but stopped when a Ford pickup emerged from Oak Street, turning left, and parked near the curb. 5 men were crouched down in the bed, all holding guns. The passenger side window slid down and Mark Henry, who ran the feed store, stuck his head out.
"Sheriff, what the hell's going on? We heard something about some crazy person killing people."
"It's the monster," Berman yelled. The wind ripped the words from his lips.
"Monster?"
Henry's face crinkled.
"Yes, damn it, the monster! You've heard the stories!"
"But they're just stories."
"Scoot over!"
Berman opened the door and slid into the cab. Andy Harless was driving. He nodded at Berman, and Berman returned the greeting. Andy piloted the truck along the road. Despite the chains on the tires, it slid and wobbled. Snow had begun to accumulate on the pavement. At the top of Main, Berman saw the blazing shell. Andy pulled the truck to a stop and rolled down the window. A man in a cowboy hat ran up.
"It went east,"
he was saying.
"All right,"
Andy grunted and rolled the window back up.
"East?"
Berman asked. There was nothing in the east except forest and a few isolated homesteads.
"Take Potter's Road."
A half mile from the station, Andy turned right onto Potter's Road, which dipped down and followed a rocky stream bed on US 45 15 miles away. Berman spotted the monster immediately. It was trudging through the grasslands below Pine Point.
"There!"
Berman called, pointing.
"I see it,"
Andy said. He stepped on the gas and the truck leapt forward.
"Slow down,"
Berman commanded.
"I'm gonna cut him off."
Up ahead, a little wooden bridge crossing the creek bed on the right gave access to the field. The monster hadn't yet reached the bridge.
"The road's too messy. Slow down."
Andy didn't listen, likely imagining himself as Steve McQueen in The Getaway. He punched the gas harder. Close to the bridge, he let up and spun the wheel, perhaps expecting to slid across. Instead, the truck rolled, flipping end over end on the highway, shedding pieces of itself for 30 feet and throwing men onto the pavement, crushing them. Screaming, Berman held on as the world spun around him. When he came to, he was lying on the pavement, pinned under the truck. His back hurt, his head hurt, his stomach especially hurt. The wind shrieked. Cold. It was so cold. Then he smelled the gasoline, and suddenly it was hot. Too hot. Steve Berman wailed as the flames enveloped him. It took him a long, long time to die. The state police arrived in Pine Point at 4:28 p.m. An accident on Main Street Bridge slowed them down. A single body lied in the main street, half covered in snow, its brain smudged across the asphalt. The fire at the shell had been contained by local fire officials, though several bodies lied here and there. Miles east, the beast picked its way through the brush and undergrowth. Over the next 10 hours, it attacked three isolated farms, killing two people and wounding three others. By sunrise, it had changed course. Now it was heading southwest, towards LA.